From the halls of every school in Michigan, this is School Talks on 760 WJR with Dr. Robert Livernoy. Sponsored by Wakely Associates, Plant Moran Real Point, Collins and Plaha, O'Reilly Rancilio PC Attorneys at Law, and by Clark Construction. Now take your seats. Class is in session. Here's Robert.
This week on School Talks, we'll take you through the entire process of what happens when a student makes a threat to a school. Our distinguished panel includes Andre Buford, principal of Paul K. Cusno High School in Warren, from Care Solace, Brian Peters and Vicki Wilson, private practice psychologist Nikki O'Donnell, and from Rochester Community Schools, Superintendent Nick Russo, and high school counselors Christy Clement and Chris Green. All this and more coming up. This is School Talks on 760 WJR.
This is School Talks on WJR with Dr. Robert Livernoy.
Joining us now on the program is Andre Buford, principal of Paul K. Cusno High School in Warren Consolidated Schools. Welcome to the program, Andre.
Thank you for having me.
So, Andre, part of this program today is dedicated to helping people understand what happens in a school when a student makes a threat. Okay. And my goal is to help people understand all the different points in the wheel of a threat that a student and a family go through. And it always starts at the school level. And in your recent experience, what has been some of the types of threats you've received? And more importantly, how are you receiving them?
All right. Well, most of our threats lately have been through social media. A lot of times it's a parent or a student that got wind of a social media threat and it gets directed to us. Once it gets to us, we send it over to our director of security, crisis and security. And that person usually does a good job of getting with our local authorities, and then they vet out whether it's credible or not.
Mm-hmm. And when you say someone brings you the threat, I know in the culture and work consolidated schools that we encourage both students and families to report difficult information. And in your experience, are you more likely to receive information from a student or a parent?
A lot of times, believe it or not, our students are stepping up to the plate and giving us that information. We have what you call okay to say. Mm-hmm. And a lot of our students will utilize that platform to get things to us. But beyond that, our students don't have a problem reaching out to us themselves.
Sure. And okay to say is a anonymous tip line sponsored by the Michigan State Police, where students, anyone really can call in and report an anonymous tip about someone who is planning to do harm or other things. And it's proven to be a pretty important connection to schools. And as a result of that, we're able to get that kinds of information. So let's take a threat comes in, say, from, well, let me ask you this. What are some of the more popular social media apps that you're seeing threats on?
The most popular one is Snapchat. Beyond that, you'll get an Instagram Instagram threat here or there, but the most popular one is Snapchat, and every now and again, somebody may see something through TikTok.
And in Snapchat, as I understand it, is it pretty easy for someone to quickly create a profile and then create a threat and then eliminate the profile?
Yes, they can do that. Also, within 24 hours, all snaps disappear. Mm-hmm. So that's usually the students' most preferred method to get things out.
And, you know, another important point I want School Talks listeners to know is when you send a threat through an app, that's a different mechanism than screenshotting a threat and sending it as a photo in a text message.
Correct.
However, it always reverts back to the IP address tied to the phone or wherever it's sent from that allows law enforcement to track that kind of threat, whether it's a photo or not, especially if the student is able to be identified in a short amount of time. And I know for years that has been what we call the cat and mouse game of trying to understand who issued the threat and whatnot. In Warren Consolidated Schools, tell us a little bit about the homicide-suicide protocol that the district uses with regard to students who that have everyone's attention.
All right, once we figure out who the student was that made the threat, they're immediately put on what we call a homicide protocol. That is a process where they have to meet with administration and the counseling committee at the school, or the counselors at the school. And we go through a process where they have to go and see a licensed professional before they can be deemed cleared to be in school safely. That's just the one part of it. After that, even if they're deemed to be in school again, there's still a discipline side of that that we deal with that we'll likely talk about as well.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, for many, many years, schools have had a suicide protocol, where we had a list of things to look for in a student who may be depressed or withdrawn or whatnot. And in recent years, it has sort of morphed into a homicide protocol also, given the extraordinary fear and attention that school violence drives into schools. Joining us right now on the program is Andre Buford. He is the principal of Paul K. Cusno High School in Warren. And we're talking about what happens when the school principal, such as him, receives a threat. Once the threat's in, the students manage and so on, talk a little bit about your obligation to communicate with the rest of the school and the parents, given how rapidly communication travels.
Yeah, so whether the threat is deemed credible or not, we make it a point to first notify the entire community and the staff. It's done within minutes of each other. We make sure the staff knows that there was a threat and that it's been vetted out completely, and then we do the same thing with the community. Part of that letter that goes out to the community is the reminder that we need every parent to always talk to their students about the importance of not only just reporting those types of threats, but the extreme consequences that you could have if you're a student that decides to make a threat like that. And it's done constantly whenever we have these.
Mm-hmm. And in the last few school threats that you've dealt with, what have been some of the discipline issued to students in terms of duration and whatnot? Talk a little bit about what happens to a student if they are cleared to come back to school.
On the school side, once they're cleared to come back to school, if you've made a threat of that nature and we know that you've made that threat, we put you up for what we call a disciplinary hearing. We don't do a 5-day or a 10-day suspension with that. We look towards possibly making you find another school to go to. And we take it that seriously because we want our students to know that the first priority in our district is safety. So anyone that is willing to make that kind of threat, they may need to find somewhere else to go.
And you know, you really shed an important light on, and I know this is more of a mental health issue for discussion later. My experience in education is children in high school lack the ability to think abstractly in terms of what's going to happen to me if I do this, and impulse sort of takes over. But that is certainly for another conversation. So with regard to the types of threats, the student gets put out of school. When they do return to school, are they put on any kind of behavior contract, or how do you pay attention to them once they do come back, if in fact they're cleared from a therapist or someone?
Believe it or not, the first thing that we do is to try to make sure the student feels welcomed again. So we speak to them and talk to them regularly. But to make it back out of that disciplinary hearing, one of the first things that happens is that they are put on a strict behavior contract. So anything that they do outside of this event could also put them back in that scenario again where they'll have to find another school. But we do, since we put them through the protocols, we do understand that those kids can make mistakes at times, and we try to make them feel acclimated in the building again, but they have to know that if they make that kind of mistake again, they'll need somewhere else to go.
And you raise a really important point. Those students who come back, or even when you first encounter them, do you have a sense of how many of them tell you, "I was only joking"?
You get that 100% of the time. 100%. The process takes away any chance of you letting your gut make the right or wrong decision. So
that's an excellent point. Andre Buford, principal of Paul K. Cusno High School in Warren Consolidated Schools, I want to thank you for joining us on the program and, more importantly, giving our School Talks listeners a window into what really happens when a threat comes forward and some of the mechanics that the school employs to make sure things are done correctly. I appreciate your time.
No problem. Thank you.
Coming up after the break, we'll be joined by Brian Peters and Vicki Wilson from Care Solace. You're listening to School Talks on 760 WJR.
This is School Talks on WJR with Dr. Robert Livernoy, sponsored by Wakely Associates, Plant Moran Real Point, Collins and Blaha, O'Reilly Rancilio PC Attorneys at Law, and by Clark Construction. Once again at the head of the class, Dr. Livernoy.
Joining us now on the program is Brian Peters and Vicki Wilson from Care Solace. Brian is an award-winning author and former professor at the Milwaukee School of Engineering. He's an author, a speaker, a consultant, and works on things related to improvement systems and outcomes. And Brian joined Care Solace to support their mission to provide timely and equitable access to mental health and substance use treatment to school communities. And with him is Vicki Wilson, an author with 30 years of experience as a public school educator, having served as a classroom teacher and a principal. She is internationally recognized coach and educational consultant, and she inspires people through reflective thought and growth to make a greater impact in the work that they do at Care Solace. I want to thank you both for joining us on the program today.
Thank you for having us, Robert.
Thank you.
So part of Care Solace, one of the most important things I learned about Care Solace is the support you provide to families and students who are subject to being put out of school for a threat or concerns with mental health or something. And sort of that is the anchor of this. Tell us a little bit about Care Solace.
Yeah, as the nation's largest and fastest growing K-12 mental health conduit, we provide access to mental health services and support to over 19 million families across the country, with almost 600,000 of those being right here in the state of Michigan.
Wow, so you said over 500,000 here in Michigan.
Almost close to 600 now.
Almost 600,000, 19 million families nationwide. So specifically, how does Care Solace support a family of a student who has been put out of school for either a suicidal or a homicidal ideation?
Yeah, it is incredibly difficult to get access to services for a lot of families. It can take anywhere from 15 to 17 weeks, depending on the time of year and the geographic area that the family is located. And Care Solace has been able to average just under 2 days to be able to find matches for families that are typically pretty close to them. 95% of all the work that we do is live in person within a traversable area for families. And we've been able to get families a qualified provider that is a good fit for the family, typically in under 10 days over the last 3 to 4 years that we've serviced families in Michigan.
So Care Solace, you must have access to your own network of providers in a region such as Southeast Michigan. Is that how that works?
Yes and no. We do a wonderful job combing an area and looking at all available resources, whether it is a hospital network, whether it's a county agency, whether it's a clinic. A lot of it is private practice. We vet to make sure that the provider has a license in good standing, no disciplinary action against that provider. And over time, we will ask families about their feedback and how that provider has worked out for their family, so we can make sure that we have a provider pool that is high quality and that is servicing our school communities to the best extent that we possibly can.
Yeah, so walk us through. You have a student who's put out of school, and in many, many cases, in my experience, the family may not have the right kind of insurance, mm-hmm. or they might not have the resources to pay for the necessary mental health services or screenings or whatnot to determine whether their child is safe to return to school. Help help us understand how you work with a family like that to achieve the support they need.
Yeah, that's a great question. So the reality is that our schools have more contact with students, more contact with families than just about anybody else in a community. They know the student, they know the family, they have a good idea of what those needs are, but to the extent that our schools currently operate, they're not staffed or funded as a mental health organization. So they rely on those outside connections and those providers to be able to support those students. A good example is if you think about a student population in general, there are about, if you have 100 kids that are identified as needing additional support or what a school community would deem needs that go beyond what the school system has a capacity to support, only 18% of those ever end up getting the help and support that they need. And the majority of those are not actually happy with the placements that have been provided. That's because from a resource standpoint, schools are using a resource list. That list might be 3, 4, 5 years old. It's not updated as regularly as some might think. And districts will oftentimes cannibalize each other's resources by looking at what the neighboring school systems are doing. So you're competing for the ability to see those providers, which causes those long wait times, which leads to those 17-week waits that families have to deal with to be able to access a provider. What we do is we try to look at all available resources, all available providers, talk with the family, do an intake to figure out what exactly it is that they need. We'll ask questions about their geographic proximity to certain providers, how far they're willing and able to travel, if they have any language preferences, if they have any gender, racial, religious, or ethnic preferences that we can take into consideration as we look for those possible fits. Because we do believe that quality of fit is incredibly important.
So joining us on the program right now is Brian Peters and Vicki Wilson from Carousalis, an important conduit between schools and mental health support for students. So, Vicki, a question for you. In your experience as a principal, what kind of feedback have you received from schools and families as it relates to the services that Carousalis provide?
Yeah, thank you. Well, I was a principal for 16 years in Wyandotte, and one thing I want to say is I saw like a tremendous shift in the need of mental health support for families, for students. And when I first learned about their services, one of the things that really stood out to us is how this a program like this will help our social workers in the job that they were doing, which was just becoming more and more overwhelming, and it was harder and harder. We were adding social workers, but there were only so many to be had anymore. So my first thought was that this would make a tremendous difference in supporting our social workers who are helping families connect to services and pull some things off of their plate because the needs have gotten so great. But what I found is after we did that, it absolutely did do that. Our social workers loved it. But it also really started to play into the conversations that I was having with families around attendance and with our teams on MTSS. So there's a student that has a need. They're not learning at the level we're expecting them to. And so what is that? And as you peel back those layers, many times we were finding a mental health element to that related to the prevention.
Sure. You mentioned MTSS. Could you tell us a little bit about what that is and how it plays into what you're talking about?
Absolutely. So that's really where you bring a team of professionals together to talk about the student, look at the results of their learning and their assessments to try to figure out what is the obstacle in place that is preventing them at being at grade level. And as we go through that, oftentimes we find that disengagement might have a lot to do with it. And what's causing that disengagement? It could be a mental health issue for the student. It also could be a mental health issue related to their family or someone else in the home, which has a tremendous impact on the child and the learning. And if we can identify that and support the family in getting the services that they need, it really can make a difference. And also with early intervention in that, it could prevent more trauma happening to the child and the family if we could get the family the help that they need.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, in Michigan, there is an effort to focus on restorative justice and restorative practices in school mm-hmm. as a means of helping children adapt and adjust and solve problems, especially relationship problems. And given how often students are put out of school for threats and conflict with other students, does CARE Solace in some way utilize or support these kinds of restorative practices?
Yeah, I think, you know, thinking about school safety, and it is a top priority, one of the things we want to do with early intervention and supporting students and families early is being able to help them connect to services that can build the empathy and can build their ability to be resilient in difficult situations. So while CARE Solace is a tremendous help and support in the emergency situations of homicidal threats, suicidal threats, there's also that other layer of what's going on with all of our students and how can we intervene and help them early before it elevates to that level.
Fantastic work. Brian Peters and Vicki Wilson from CARE Solace, I want to thank you for joining us on the program and, more importantly, the important work you're doing in supporting students, families, and the staff who serve them. I appreciate your time today.
Thank you, Robert.
Thank you, Robert.
After a word from our sponsors, we'll have private practice psychologist Nikki O'Donnell on the program to learn how she determines whether a student is actually a threat to a school or someone who just made a bad choice. You're listening to School Talks on 760 WJR.
School Talks on WJR with Dr. Robert Livernoy.
Joining us now on the program is Nikki O'Donnell, a private practice psychologist right here in Commerce, Michigan. She's also the founder of a nonprofit for youth mental health and does a lot of work with schools in supporting them and their supports of students who have mental health challenges. Welcome to the program, Nikki.
Thank you.
So, Nikki, part of this program has been dedicated to what happens to a student when they make a threat at school. And I imagine in your line of work, you've seen your fair share of students who come to you after having been put out of school. And first and foremost, and I know it's on the minds of many School Talks listeners, and that is, when a student first comes to you, what is your first line of approach with them to try to assess whether or not they're really a threat?
Mm-hmm. So it's unique, especially working with children and their families in a really high stress situation, because you know already what they've been through that whole day and probably what a debacle and, you know, all the excitement and concern and emotion. So coming right off the bat, my very first thing is just acknowledging for a kid that they are also a human just like me, and that we're in this situation together, and we're going to navigate some things, and I'm going to ask some tough questions, but to align with a child and their parents, because they're also very, very scared and fearful, and, you know, they, dealing with their own response to what's happened.
You know, you shed a really important light on the fact that as much as this feels like a procedure for school mm-hmm. and courts and police departments, for many, many families, this is overwhelming.
Very overwhelming.
When they're faced with the scary term of your son is facing a 20-year
yes.
felony. Well, what does that mean? My son's 14 years old and they come to your office. So as you get to know the student and start working through this issue, what are some of the signs or behaviors that you look for that might be most credible or critical in determining whether they really are a threat? What do you look for?
Yeah, it's interesting. I actually worry way less about the kids who make active threats than the ones who don't. And that's right. It's a lot of times the concerns fly under the radar. So if they've made it to the point where they're already making a threat, right, there's already, you know, it is boiled over. There's something happening there. So there's like procedural things, of course, that as a clinician that I'm asking and looking for and screening for things like suicidality. You know, are you a threat to yourself or others? Do you feel safe at home? We're looking for all those basics. But the way that I tie it in is just in a very basic conversation with kids, like, wow, this is probably real scary. Like, fill me in. Like, what was going on there today? And typically through those conversations, I can check all of my boxes. So I'm looking for things like, have they had any over the past 6 months? You know, what's their life look like? This wasn't just a, like, you, this isn't the, you know, if there's a real issue happening there, it didn't just pop up yesterday. So I kind of look at the fuller picture to get an idea of sort of what were we dealing with before this happened, or what was flying under the radar that we needed to address, and how can we now do that?
What I appreciate about that approach is you're really looking for what the underlying issues are that might make a student say something or, God forbid, actually do something. Am I correct in what you just labeled? Is it known as a lethality checklist, as scary as that sounds?
It is. Yep.
It's a list of things that you look for to try to narrow down the, I guess, the specificity of the threat. So in the rare occasion, and I want to believe that of all the students you've seen, is it fair to assume that most of them in your assessment really are not homicidal?
In my experience, they're not.
Yeah.
I had one kid in particular. He was a ninth grader and started a fire at a school. Like an actual, like this was, there was no threat that was happening, but that is threatening. But what's so interesting is that's terrifying to think about. Not homicidal at all, but in a lot of pain and required. There was a lot going on home. You know, kids are, their emotional centers of their brain are developed fully at nine. And the part of the brain, the front part that controls and manages all of that, won't fully develop until they're 25.
Right.
That's why when we pick partners very young, we're like, wow, that's interesting that I made these decisions then. Your brain was different.
And, you know, that's a critical 16-year period when you think about your ability to think abstractly. So right now joining us on the program is psychologist Nikki O'Donnell. And we're talking about her role as a psychologist who works with students who've been put out of school for making a threat or maybe considering harming themselves. And in that lens, the students who are removed from school immediately, how often are you dealing with families that really don't have the necessary resources?
Almost all the time. Right. Almost every time.
Yeah, because I would imagine it's hard for you, given it's a case-by-case, to put a number on how many times you need to see someone before you can make a decision. And it sort of flies in that same face of this is not nearly as procedural as people think. You know, when you get a speeding ticket, you get pulled over, they give you a piece of paper, they tell you what your court date is, they tell you what the fine, you know, it's very procedural. And in this arena, it is so fluid. And I want to talk a little bit about how you work with families who may not have the resources and what kind of supports you can provide them, because time is money.
Yeah.
And it certainly is. And maybe this connects to your nonprofit, if you want to tell us a little bit about that.
Sure. So I was this kid. So I grew up with parents with mental health issues and on drugs. I mean, this was my reality. And I wasn't the kid that was going to make the threat, but it was all going to come inward, right? Which we see this a ton with kids screening for depression and anxiety very young. Something changed, as everyone can imagine, after 2020 and the isolation that occurred. My job changed dramatically. I think everybody in this field, it motivated me to become and kind of step more out of my clinical arena and move more into advocacy. Because I think there is, I have a unique perspective that sort of led to starting this nonprofit for youth in our community, Words of Hope for Life. And the goal there was, how do we create community connection? The statistic that always sticks with me is for children, the most protective factor for them is having one other adult in their life that's not a parent that they know they can really trust.
So psychologist Nikki O'Donnell, you've given our School Talks listeners so much to think about. I want to thank you for joining us on the program, and keep up the good work. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
Coming up after the break, we'll hear from the team at Rochester Community Schools and how they support students in the school environment. We'll be back right after this. This is School Talks on 760 WJR.
Talks on WJR is sponsored by Wakely Associates, Point Moran Real Point, Collins and Blaha, O'Reilly Rancilio PC Attorneys at Law, and by Clark Construction.
Joining us on the program now from Rochester Community Schools is Superintendent Nick Russo, along with two high school counselors, Christy Clement and Chris Green. I'd like to welcome you all to School Talks.
Thank you. Thanks, Bob.
Thank you.
So, Superintendent Russo, what is your school district's approach to caring for students during a traumatic situation? And part of our broadcast has been dedicated to what schools go through when they receive a threat. And in Rochester, tell us a little bit about how you take care of the students there.
Yeah, I think it's important to remember that it's a team approach, right? We have, it's more than just one person that addresses a student or students who are in a traumatic situation. We have a team of counselors, psychologists, caregivers. You know, this, we work with the parents, we work with local law enforcement, and community partnerships too that we have with our local support systems that surround our district. It's really important to keep lines of communication open and make sure that we're all focused on what the trauma was and how we can address those needs. So working with, again, the families is really, really critical. And continuing to provide resources while students are either in the trauma or post-traumatic situations.
And that goes for students who may unfortunately been one who issued the threat and whether or not they come back to school, but maybe of, I wouldn't say more importance, but all those students who are affected by it, just given how scary it is. That's a fair assessment?
Yeah, I think the trauma can have a ripple effect for who experiences it and who kind of, for lack of better words, is the perpetrator or alleged perpetrator.
Sure, sure. So, you know, for years, high school counselors have been viewed as someone who helps students do academic planning, like what classes you want to take to go to school, college, or what you plan to do after high school. Chris Green from Rochester High School, tell us a little bit about how counselors help students beyond that academic realm as it relates to our discussion today.
Well, we want to help students transition throughout their lives and become independent adults. So we want to help them, you know, establish how are you going to make good decisions in your life? How are you going to connect those decisions to what's important for yourself? We also want to help those students who are struggling with making decisions. So using those as learning opportunities and helping them to process. We also want to support all of those who are supporting the students. So the child's families, we're going to provide them with resources. We're going to be available to meet with them on an as-needed basis. And as students are seeing things throughout their lives in high school, so whether it's through the news or in the high school, we again want to be a supportive place where they can come and discuss those things and process them and best help understand them. We really just want to be available whenever they're going through something, so there's a safe place where they can talk about it and kind of figure out, you know, how are they feeling and what might be a next step for them.
Yeah, and for context, how many students approximately are at Rochester High School?
About 1,700 at Rochester.
All right, so 1,700 students all coming from families, you know, many if not most probably have siblings and, you know, parents and step-parents and the whole mix of the social family structure. And when I think about some of the examples that you listed, many of those are in response to things, you know, maybe the death of a parent or, you know, relationship problems or that. And oftentimes the counselor's role is sort of reactive to whatever comes to your office that day. And Christy Clement, tell us a little bit on the proactive side. What are some things that you do at the school to help and assist students either avoid these reactions or at least be prepared for them?
Thanks, Bob. Yeah, so a couple of things that counselors do is we really focus on trying to meet the kids where they are and really trying to establish those trusted relationships, you know, making sure, as Chris mentioned, that they have a safe place that they can go.
For both of you, we'll start with you. Chris Green, what do you think is a counselor's role during a traumatic situation? So let's set the table here. Let's say a threat had come into Rochester High School. The police and all the parties involved have determined it to be non-credible. What are some of the things that you employ to help children through that traumatic situation?
Well, number one, and I'm going to go back to it, we're going to provide a space. And every counseling department in our district has a place where students can come at Rochester. We call it the Calming Corner. And it's a place where students can, they don't need an appointment, they can walk in if they're going through something, and somebody's going to touch base with them. During a traumatic situation, we're going to create a large space for that. And again, we're going to allow students, if they need to come down, knowing that there's somebody there for them, where they don't have to feel isolated and alone with their thoughts or their feelings. I love the fact that Rochester Community Schools, community's in the name. And I think that's something throughout our district that we really try to establish, that this is a community. And each building has its own kind of culture and community too. It, but we want everybody to feel welcomed. We want everybody to have that feeling of safety because you are in a community. Somebody does see you. Somebody does want to talk to you and support you. So when a traumatic situation happens, whether it's in our district or even outside, there is somebody that you can go to say, you know, I'm having some feelings about this and I'd really like to discuss it with somebody, or I just want to be with somebody. I'm feeling alone. I might not even be ready to fully process what I'm going through, but somebody is going to be here for you.
And, you know, for high school kids, many of whom haven't even come close to developing their full abstract thinking capacity, if they know their, as you call it, a calming corner is available, they might not be able to articulate, you know, everything that's going on. But if they see this as a safe place, what a powerful tool. Any thoughts you want to add to that? Christy,
yeah.
Clement?
I think I would just add, you know, in addition to those supports that we provide in school, it's maintaining that relationship outside.
Yeah, and you know, when you consider all that we've discussed today, from the support for children to calming centers, the connections with the community, Rochester is a great place for children to go to school, and it's because of people like you. And I want to take a minute and thank Superintendent Nick Russo, Counselor Chris Green, and Counselor Christy Clement for joining us today on School Talks. I appreciate your insight and the great work you're doing up in Rochester.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I'd like to thank our distinguished panel today, including Cousineau High School Principal Andre Buford, from Care Solace, Brian Peters and Vicki Wilson, Private Practice Psychologist Nikki O'Donnell, and from Rochester Community Schools, Superintendent Nick Russo, and high school counselors Christy Clement and Chris Green. We'll leave it there until next week, but remember, there are two ways to spell one and three ways to spell two. Till next time, this has been School Talks on 760 WJR.